by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make the heaven a middle of it. Rest make the heaven a middle. We are. Rest make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got a fine guest from California for Sanford University. Her name is Anand Amanti, and my gosh, she's really a fine lady, economist, a financial advisor, and professor of finance and economics there at Sanford University. She was recently a guest of the over in Davos, Switzerland, of the World Economic Forum. Anyway, welcome to our program, Dr. Amanti.
Thank you very much.
I tell you what. Yes. How was your recent trip over to Davos? Was that your first time, or what?
It was my first time, and I first thought that they wouldn't want somebody like me who might disturb the party.
Well,
but they tolerated me at least this one time, and gave me an opportunity to speak a little bit.
Right. You're the author of The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. Tell us about your background a little bit for our listening audience to sort of get familiar with you, and then we'll get into the book.
Okay. Thank you. So my background is that I became an academic in the area of finance. I didn't start that way, but in graduate school I became, my background originally was in mathematics and statistics, and then I learned some more economics and became interested in issues around the financial markets, although I never became an advisor or anything. I've been teaching and doing research on financial markets, on how the markets work, how the trading works, how information gets into the prices, can it break down, like we have crashes and things, meaning even trading, and became interested more recently, in recent years, in more issues around governance. And governance is basically, you know, who makes decision and how you govern corporations, you know, who are the corporations for their managers, or do they work for the shareholders, do they work for other people, can they, who makes the decisions there and why, and how you control them. So I became interested in that, and after the financial crisis, I became curious about the industry of banking. I've been teaching at Stanford Business School and to some of our Stanford students more generally, courses on corporate finance and how corporations make decisions and how they interact with financial markets. And I started looking after 2008, 5 years ago or a little more, when it became very scary, more and more closely into the financial industry and more the banking industry. And I became increasingly concerned with some of the things I heard and saw done, and with the practices of this industry and with the regulation of this industry and how people were talking about it. Enough so that I started speaking up about policy issues, which before that I was not that much into, in terms of you do need policy to control this industry, and so I think that there's a lot of confusion about what's going on there, and that's kind of the background for the book and for my eventually, you know, going to Davos to because I became sufficiently outspoken, I guess, about some of the issues that I started thinking more people need to understand them, or you can't get anywhere.
Right. What stands out is the reference to Paul Volcker. Boy,
yeah.
I tell you, you're a gutsy lady. I'll say that, Doctor. You're a gutsy lady, because really, I've been looking at Davos for 10, 15 years or more, and I've been reporting on it on my radio program along with Charlotte Littlefield for at least 3 or 4 years. In fact, we played back some of those clips last weekend on our program. We broadcast every Saturday night. But anyway, you were in a den of bankers and internationalists and financiers, and so your particular opinions were in conflict with what most of those people were saying, is it not? Were they not?
Yes, I mean, if you saw the, I only the week before that heard, watched on the video a forum debate that was the parallel one from last year, in which Jamie Dimon was on it and other people, and it was a depressing show where the moderator seemed quite taken with the large banks. JP Morgan seemed to do little wrong, because it could make money even if it could lose, in a scandal, or it could pay fines or whatever. That was just a cost of doing business, and otherwise it was a wonderful organization. Well, that's not my view of these institutions. Paul Volcker, I think you're referring to how I ended my comments there.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Well, you use a term that's very, very frequently used here in Texas. You know what I mean? That BS term, we use that all the time.
Yes, yes.
We've got a lot of cows down here. You know what I mean? A lot of bulls and cows, you know?
I wondered whether to, I actually, even in the context of an op-ed I wrote for the New York Times, I wondered about that quote, and I think Mr. Volcker, was being very forthright, and maybe he doesn't usually use that language, but apparently it was the correct quote, and I had very limited time there in which to take on the banking industry in 5 minutes, and so I needed to sort of say my views first and then just say very briefly why a lot of what they're saying is nonsense of various kinds. You know, either it's kind of twisted, misleading argument, or it's just complete and utter nonsense, which is sort of the reference in my the title of our book, The Banker's New Clothes, is basically these things that are not really there. So we refer to kind of flawed argument, bad argument, anywhere from absolute fallacious nonsense to some kind of a twisted excuse or narrative. And so the quote that I think you're referring to, if you want to, I'll repeat it here, comes from a book by a person named Jeff Connaughton. He wrote a book named entitled Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. The book came out a little bit after our book, or after our book was finalized anyway, in around the winter, about a little over a year ago. And the person writing it was a staffer of a senator who was just a senator for a couple of years, taking Biden space when Biden became vice president to Obama, and this was Senator Ted Kaufman. But before that, actually, Jeff Connaughton worked for Joe Biden for a while, and then he became a lobbyist, and so he knew Washington, D.C. and all the lobbying that goes on for the banks, very front and center. And in this book, he describes, there are a couple of quotes that I particularly like that we would have quoted in our book if it wasn't already done. And one of them is a conversation between Paul Volcker and the Senator Kaufman, in which Ted Volcker, I will only paraphrase the quote a little bit. I was reading the precise quote. And the quote is, anytime anybody proposes anything about the banks, no matter what it is, the banks will always come out and say that, whatever it is you want to do, it will harm credit, it will restrict credit and harm the economy. That's always the threat.
Sure.
And that scares the politicians. And then he paused, and in the book he's describing how they were waiting for him to say the next thing, in which then came after the pause, it's all BS. Apparently, this particular exchange was quoted in the New Yorker in a story about the book, and the New Yorker went to verify the quote. And Mr. Volker remembered the exchange, and in the book it says actually it spells out bullshit, but Volker remembered that he said BS. Anyway, same thing, you know.
You're going to go down in history at Davos for saying that on the stage.
I was nervous about saying it, but then I kept saying, you know, I'm quoting. It's not usually how I talk, but I am quoting somebody big shot.
Right. You know, I was watching you live, Doctor, and I recorded it live on the audio part. See what I mean? And I couldn't believe that. I mean, that made your point. You know what I mean? I mean, you couldn't have brought up anything that was more explicitly to the point that summarized all these different arguments those bankers are using as to they're not really worthy of you know, only this, right? You know what I mean?
Right. There's just so much of different kinds of nonsense that really that word captured.
In fact,
Paul Volcker has a blurb from my book, which was hard to get him to kind of pay attention and give the blurb because his biography was coming at the time, and we tried in many ways to reach out to him. And after I read this quote and I was still trying to get him to endorse my book, I wrote to him, how about if you just say that our book explains why it's BS?
Right. Okay. Yeah.
He did not quite say it that way. I think what he said at the back of the book, that, you know, the book explains in plain English why, despite what they tell you, financial reform is not quite done.
Right. In Texas, we use that term in common language, like if we're talking to someone that's a liar and no good, well, we'll just say he's full of BS. See what I mean? And so that, you know, means nonsense or he's a liar or whatever, you know. In your studies, how did the Glass-Steagall Act, the repeal of that under, well, being pushed by Phil Graham, did that set up the banks to go into a casino mode or what?
You know, it's interesting you're asking me this right now because I taught all morning and I started teaching a course here at Stanford because I really feel like, you know, people need to educate about all this stuff called Finance and Society. And this morning we were talking just about the issue of the banking history in the U.S. and specifically, you know, the Glass-Steagall and all the and their appeal of Glass-Steagall and all of those structural issues where banks were able more and more and more and your bringing up, so the repeal of Glass-Steagall is considered the Graham Bailey the 1999 repeal, but there were steps there, and Phil Graham was actually one of the people who was not mentioned well in today's class in the sense of allowing banks. From the time that, you know, the business of banking was defined as in a quite limited way in the Banking Act of, you know, 1863, until it became encroached as the banks became envious of more and more exciting businesses and wanted to do more and more and more in the 70s and especially later and into the 90s where they were just watching these investment banks make money in all kinds of things and where they wanted more and more exemptions from an allowance to do derivatives and to do other things that because the law was ambiguous with the explicit help of the OCC, definitely a culprit in all of that. Always defining things so that the business of banking became this malleable kind of concept, so vague that you could drive just about anything through it. And eventually they were able to basically get into everything. And by now you read how they basically own, you know, commerce, definitely, and even physical commodities and energy and oil and you name it. And so, and certainly derivatives, which was the one place where they got allowed to do that starting in the 80s and starting in the 90s especially where nobody pushed back against it, and by now the genie is kind of out of the box. So Glass-Steagall was actually only a little sort of strange part of what was before that, sort of the what were later various other restrictions, Bank Holding Company Act and others. So
yes,
the issues are
right.
legal, but
yeah, that
but anyway, bottom line is that between the abolition of Glass-Steagall and the erosion of many, many ways in which there were walls erected supposedly between, you know, banking institutions that take deposits and all kinds of other businesses, from security business, which investment banking by itself is not that risky, but just advising and helping companies bring issues. But the other parts of it, the casino parts that you referred to, we now have serious kind of monstrous institutions and a really, really dangerous system in our hands.
Well, who can actually, when you mentioned derivatives, who has a handle on that, and who can actually construct some kind of a model as to what the liability or overhang to the major banks is? Is there anyone that really knows the real liabilities of the derivatives on major banks, international banks?
This is an excellent question, because derivatives are the kind of contract. I mean, what is a derivative? It's basically, think of it like an insurance contract. Think of it like it's a sort of a contingent commitment. It's like a bet on something. So it's a kind of contract that says, I'll pay you such and such in this event. And so, and these things are really scalable up, and the kinds of liabilities, they create a kind of a leverage and indebtedness, but in very strange indirect ways. But the exposure can be enormous. So basically you have something called the notional value of the derivative, which is basically kind of, you know, if you buy an insurance, it's basically if it's a total loss, so the maximum you can be paid. So that's like the notional, how much in a worst case scenario, you know, there would be like a liability from one side to the other. And, but there are other things, like, so the derivatives could be like basically a contract in which, you know, it's like it's called a swap. So I pay fixed interest versus variable interest, and we kind of change around these things. Or I kind of get into commitment to buy something at a fixed price later, like a forward kind of thing, future, on and on and on and on. And so, the problem with these contracts is that they have been very, very opaque. So it was always very difficult to see what anybody, what exactly was the risk. And once the banks were allowed to do that, we kind of lost track of their risk. So, you know, Jamie Dimon would come and say, oh, I have a fortress balance sheet, but the risks that are lurking are often not seen. And so, you know, there's sort of a balance sheet, you know, what you owe and your assets and liabilities and all of that, but the derivatives are very difficult to measure on those. So what they're trying to do right now is to maybe bring them a little bit more into light, because the history of course goes back to Alan Greenspan and to massive deregulation, where in the 90s they just thought that all financial innovation is for the good and this system will self-regulate and it will be okay and it's all a wonderful system, only to sort of again allow this monster to grow. And derivatives were very much part of it. So at the time there were attempts in the 90s to regulate them more, to at least to get more transparency into these markets. And it was a combination of people actually in the Clinton era that shut that off. So that's a story that's been told about the CFTC, the Commodities and Futures Council, a regulator in Chicago of the futures and options market somewhat. And they didn't want to regulate these markets, and they really became, bigger and bigger, partly for this reason, for the allowance, of these activities by just about any bank or bank holding company or financial holding company or whatever. Anyway, and so, to your question, can we contain the system? It's very, there were attempts in Dodd-Frank Act, which supposedly is the reform that's going to solve all our problems, to shine more light and to kind of force derivative transactions into, they call them clearing houses, but that's not even that. And of course, you know, you saw what happened with JP Morgan Chase in this London whale. They went trading in derivatives in London in these over-the-counter markets, and By the way, this was excess deposit. So this is what they were doing with the deposit money that they weren't lending. And then they tell us that they won't lend. You know, they have plenty of money to lend. They just lack the will to do that. They have other more exciting things to do. But anyway, so there are attempts. I am concerned that maybe it's not enough. I mean, you can, you know, in the debate that you're referring to in Davos, my sort of teammate, the hedge fund manager, Paul Singer from Elliott, is a very aggressive hedge fund, by the way, was focusing on derivatives and opacity, saying the eye-catching phrase from him was that derivatives were not a net negative for society, even though he likes to play in those markets. And he's a hedge fund who, presumably, if he fails, you know, it'd be more like MF Global. It won't kind of take the economy down with it, but kind of weapons of mass destruction in the language of Warren Buffett. And so he was expressing that there's too much risk and it's too hidden, and I agree with that. So can we? I think if there was political will to do that, there's much more that can be done. The steps that they are nominally taking, and Gary Gensler, who was the head of the CFTC, was making heroic efforts there in the right direction, are kind of moving in the right direction. But I'm concerned that when you have a central clearing, you're kind of moving, you're always moving the problem somewhere else, and the clearinghouses can be a major sort of some people call it the mother of too big to fail, very highly interconnected entities. So I prefer that they bring a lot of derivatives into actual exchanges like the New York Stock Exchange, where you can really see the trades, and there's a real there's less of an ability to hide that risk.
I've understood here recently through my research that they've consolidated all derivative tradings into the Chicago markets. And there's a couple of ideas and concepts here I wanted to run past you. One is too big to mm-hmm. fail, and the other one was systemically important banks.
Yep.
You know, now those are guises to hide that they're really in trouble, it looks like to me, with this derivative overhang. What do you think?
Well, I think that I don't. There's still a lot of derivative trading that is over the counter, so it's not quite. And sometimes they just require that there be an intermediary in the hope that the intermediary would somehow, you know, require margins and kind of. But I don't know how reassuring that whole thing would be. But in truth, I'm not an actual expert on this part of it, the attempts to kind of, you know, bring the derivatives into this. I know that they're still sort of hidden, and that there are a lot of times if you read about what the banks do, and if you try to read their disclosures, it's very hard to actually see those exposures because so little is being disclosed, not much to really know the risk.
There's a lot of off balance.
Exactly.
Risk.
Exactly. And in fact, the way they lobbied with the accounting board, with the financial accounting standard board, is, and this is one part of a disagreement we display in the book, just graphically, just how much that can matter, is that they have, even if you don't look at sort of notional amounts, you look at the market value. So basically you have an insurance contract and, you know, if you think of an insurance contract, what's the market value of that contract? Well, you know, if the insurance is very, you know, out of the money, in other words, it's a risk that's very unlikely to happen. You know, you're insuring, for earthquake in a place where there's no earthquakes or something like that. The market value is very small. Of the contract, or a certain forward contract could start at zero market value. The market value of that could be something that you own, something somebody owes you, or what you owe. So it could be an asset or liability for you. But the way they do it is they allow netting of this. What that means is that, you know, I owe you $200 and you owe me $50, and we're just going to net the $50. And what that does, it can have, and so I can go more into that, but let's not. I just would say the following. the accounting standards in the U.S. would allow J.P. Morgan to basically shave off, you know, more than $1.5 trillion in 2011 with $1.8 trillion. This is a lot of money. Just in market value, just netted out, meaning that their assets and their debts are down by that amount. So on a balance sheet where you see how much assets and liabilities they have, you just wouldn't see this as if it didn't exist at all. So $1.8 trillion of assets and liabilities are just shaved off, entirely erased from the balance sheet. That's not to mention all the other stuff off the balance sheet, which includes all kinds of entities that they sponsor, that they are subsidiaries that are not somehow, you know, that they're not somehow included, or various other commitments that they have that are contingent commitments, on and on and on, some of which, you know, the regulators can count and all of that. Anyway, the devil is in many, many details of that. But the bottom line is that we're not seeing the beginnings of the fragilities of that system. Too big to fail? Let me just say the following. J.P. Morgan Chase by now is, by U.S. accounting standards, which is, you know, conservative on the total valuation, is four times bigger than Lehman Brothers was. By this accounting standard. If you do the accounting standards like they do in Europe, which doesn't allow as much netting of these derivatives, they are like over $4 trillion in assets. $4 trillion. And so, too big to fail. I mean, can J.P. Morgan go into bankruptcy, or what would happen if J.P. Morgan, you know, lost a lot of money? You know, and it has thousands of subsidiaries. J.P. Morgan Chase is an enormous bank holding company. It has subsidiaries from here to nowhere. It wants you to think of it as a neighborhood bank, but it's not. It is a massive institution with operations in dozens of countries and thousands of subsidiaries that are non-bank subsidiaries. That entity, that corporation, that bank holding company or financial holding company, should this company somehow, or any number of its subsidiaries, become distressed because they don't have an ability to absorb their losses, they owe money, people come to them to post collateral or whatever, the way what happened to AIG. Suddenly, what's going to happen? They're going to start, you know, destabilizing the system. Everybody who deals with them is going to want to pull their money out if they think there's any chance that they won't be paid. And suddenly, you have the sort of contagion mechanisms that, you know, we go through explaining in the book how they happen through this system. And all of a sudden, policymakers are afraid to let it fail, because it would somehow, you know, harm the economy. That's how they get bailed out. First of all, they have access to enormous amounts of support from the Fed and the central bank. The amount of sort of backstops and sort of windows to come and do the, you know, get a lender of last resort and get money to be able to survive that was thrown at the banks and at the foreign banks too was unbelievable. It was only Bloomberg after asking for data from the Fed actually squeezed with legal battle information about the extent of support that was given to the financial industry in the crisis. It boggles the mind
showed hundreds of billions of dollars being given to Dutch Bank and a lot of these foreign entities, did it not?
Exactly. In exchange for very questionable collaterals that were mortgage securities that nobody knew how much they were worth. So all this, you know, the notion of a liquidity support is basically, you know, say you forgot to, a liquidity problem is you forgot to go to the ATM at night. You know, we try to explain it in simple way. You have lots of cash, you're very strong, but you just forgot the cash and you owe somebody cash. You know, that's not a serious problem. So you have a central bank. If the bank somehow runs into a sort of a temporary liquidity problem, it won't fail for that reason. We have deposit insurance, so they won't fail for their depositors won't run to the bank and create an inefficient failure. We have all these backstops. But the line was crossed from all, you know, the blurry line between that and sort of blanket guarantees and blanket supports that all the stops were pulled. So you could say in a crisis, there are all these mechanisms of contagion, you know, the policymakers should do whatever they can. And that's the narrative they now tell you. You know, you want a safety net for, I had another presentation in Davos in which I gave analogies from other industries and from earthquakes and airplane crashing and all of that, if you want to be vivid. I gave the speed analogy in the debate that you have on webcasted. I said, you know, they were driving at 90 miles an hour, and now we have reforms that reduce the speed to 85 miles an hour, and we're still not enforcing it. You know,
anyway,
you know, the stories that are told now, it's like, oh, we saved you. You know, you want a safety net for the earthquake, you know, but this is not a natural disaster. This is really sort of man-made. It was allowed to build up in this way. And now, you know, that they kind of pulled all the stops to save it, we have the system, and in the aftermath of this system, some of these institutions became even bigger. So Jamie Dimon would tell you that he was doing a favor to all of us by buying, you know, Brest Aarons or Wachovia or something like that. But in the process of all this consolidation over the last some dozens of years, they just swallowed and swallowed and swallowed, and the incentives are to be ever bigger and ever more dangerous, because then you become too big to fail. And once you attain that status, now you really, if you have blanket subsidies and cheap funding and very little constraint on what you can do, that's a good life. You know, if you're in that position. You know, in our book, we sort of have our home borrower, Kate, and you know, that's when she has her rich aunt, Claire. And her rich aunt guarantees her debt, and then if the rich aunt told her that, you know, she'd guarantee any debt for anything, then, you know, going to Las Vegas would also seem good. Because you can take the upside, and then you keep borrowing if it doesn't work out, and until she ruins her aunt, which is basically what happened in Iceland or Ireland or Cyprus.
Right. The this word, this concept, systemically important banks, that was another category that they created to insulate themselves from bankruptcy, it looks like.
Well, I mean, that's funny, because on one hand, the best thing to be is to be systemic but not to be recognized as systemic, because nominally the regulators said, oh, we see now that all kinds of people can destabilize the system. We need more prudent regulation for an AIG or even for an investment bank, or now nobody's a pure investment bank. Even Goldman Sachs is now a bank holding company with access to the Fed, and they came begging for that status, which nominally comes with more regulation. So supposedly systemic institutions, those that you decide could harm the economy if they become distressed or fail, they're supposed to come with superior regulation. But you see, if you don't, you know, nominally the law has a lot of paradoxes in it, because on one hand it asks the big institutions to tell us how they can fail without harming us, to write living wills and things like that. On the other hand, you know, we kind of imagine that we won't dare let them go into bankruptcy, and we create a different mechanism called resolution, and we have FDIC nominally authorized to now, you know, unwind them without bailout, because everybody hates bailouts. But the question is not about bailout and who pays. The question, in my mind, is the collateral damage. In other words, you could say, oh, if the truck explodes, then the trucking industry will have to pay. But what about the dead people by the wayside? You know,
right,
in other
exactly.
words, even if they pay, you know, there's harm to other people and to the economy, no matter how good this process is. And of
That's
course,
right.
when there's a crisis, they'll say, oh, we can't impose more fines on these institutions. Look at what happens with the too big to prosecute or too big to jail, as they call it. Oh my God, if we ask them for more money or if we prosecute them, then the economy will suffer. Now they become completely immune from everything.
Well, you know what that reminds me of is that LIBOR scandal over in UK.
Yep.
See what I mean?
Yep.
That's where
did anyone ever go to prison on that or not? Well, okay, so now you get into that problem. So the too big to jail comment, the sort of our Attorney General, Eric Holder, had this sort of slip, you could say, the honest slip that sometimes come, in which he said, and this was in the context of HSBC, and HSBC had the problems of money laundering and other issues in this country. This is a big UK bank. And they always settle in all of that. And so he was saying, well, I had to think very hard whether to prosecute this bank And, you know, what does it mean to prosecute a corporation? As you said, who personally is going to jail? The corporation doesn't go to jail. And I thought, well, you know, I'd have to be careful because if they, you know, if I really go after them, then the economy will suffer. Now, you know, it raised a lot of eyebrows because he was basically saying that they're immune from the law, that they're above the law.
Exactly.
Now, LIBOR, again, what you have in LIBOR is a sort of a, you know, the question is what law was exactly broken. So LIBOR is obviously a reference interest rate that enormous amounts of contracts are written with reference to it. Even more so in Europe, where it's not just LIBOR, it's Eurobor and other bors, you know, other reference indices.
Sure,
where in this country, we have mostly fixed interest mortgages, but we also have variable rates, and they're often pegged to some kind of a rate like that, LIBOR plus this, LIBOR plus that.
Adjustable rate.
So trillion, exactly, adjustable ARMs.
Right.
So trillions and trillions and trillions, I mean, I don't know how much, contracts around the world are pegged on these. And a lot of derivative contracts are contingent on these LIBORs. Well, and other. Well, how do they determine that reference rate? They basically go around surveying these banks, asking them at what rate do they borrow from one another. Well, good luck to all of us because they had reasons to sometimes collude or sometimes misrepresent those rates. And that was sort of the situation.
Yeah, they were taking positions and then establishing a rate that would benefit their position in the market.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So they, because they had positions that were dependent on that, then sometimes they'd want them to be this way or that way, and they were helping each other tweak them.
Right.
And so you get into that, and it's a whole other can of worms. And so, of course, the spin is, oh, you know, just some people. But, you know, during the crisis, there was a systematic sort of downward pressure to misrepresent that rate, because if the rate was high, it would somehow scare people because it would say that the banks are not as safe as they said they were, because if they are, you know, you increase the interest rate for unsafe, you know, lending. So if they were afraid of one another or charged high interest, then everybody would think that they're not so healthy. Well, even the authorities didn't want to spook investors and everybody. So everybody was kind of, you know, allowing that to happen. That's why the banks, of course, said, oh, the Bank of England knew what we were doing. The other people knew what we were doing. Well, the New York Fed and the Fed, turns out, you know, also kind of knew a little bit. But, you know, you had Geithner, who was in the New York Fed at the time, you know, just sending an email to the guy in the UK saying, well, we understand that the LIBOR is manipulated, and therefore he sort of covered his, you know, his obligation, and then he didn't worry about it anymore. In fact, when the New York Fed set up a system to bail out AIG, they set it up with charging these entities that they created interest rates that were pegged to the LIBOR that he knew was too low. So, you know, now they're going to tell you how they made money from AIG. So the more, you know, spin there is, you know, there's a lot of spin. Anyway, LIBOR, again, who's going to go to jail? Well, you know, you see first of all, nobody went to jail except for very small people that go after homeowners who cheated, you know, when they were basically told to cheat by these mortgage companies. So, you know, it is remarkable that there appear to have been a lot of fraud and other mishaps, and yet personally nobody was found guilty. When they go after some mid-level people, then somehow their lawyers tell you that it was their superior or it was this or that. And then, of course, we have no accountability of the regulators who are actually supposed to monitor this system.
Right.
And so, in other words, throughout the whole system, going all the way to the regulators, and I'd even say to the politicians, there's no accountability. That's what I call other people's money. That includes taxpayers' money.
Exactly, OPM. Now, the Basel 1, 2, and 3, it appears to be on Basel 3, there was an extension of this asset, you know, evaluation or risk, you know, evaluation out to 2018. That's to cover them, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, it's So
I mean, they don't want it now. They couldn't meet it, see?
I mean, let me just give you, your listeners, a little bit of an idea of what this is, this messy debate that's happening outside the eyes of people, even though there are some occasionally, you know, there are stories that come out in the business section, but the broader public does not really appreciate. So Basel is a place where they gather to supposedly coordinate the regulation across countries, which they tell you is important to harmonize, you know, it's important. The way that this harmonization has worked, it's been a race to the bottom. So instead of our regulators thinking, you know, how to protect us, they are thinking how the banks won't be, you know, harmed against the German banks or something. So everybody worries about their banks as if, you know, we would allow our companies to pollute the river if the Chinese allow it. You know what I mean? That's almost the way it is. Anyway, Basel, was the regulation. So there's a whole history to this, just going back to not too long ago, but the Basel II agreement, which wasn't even implemented in the U.S. yet, and then it was superseded by supposedly this Basel III tough reform after 2008, supposedly constrain how much the banks should borrow and how much they should have of sort of, you know, funding from equity, from their shareholders, from their owners. And that allows the banks to do all kinds of manipulation to these, but the stop, the kind of benchmark minimal ability to absorb losses is set at 3%. 3% is sort of like buying a $300,000 house with $9,000 down.
Okay. Right.
But these are corporations, not home borrowers with collateral. These are corporations who make lots of money and can, you know, can retain their earnings and can build up their equity a lot more. Anyway, 3%. And then there are the definitions. Anyway, this regulation is very complicated. It has all kinds of measures of risk and other things. What you might be referring to is recently they basically the European banks were envious that the American banks can do so much netting of the derivatives. So they came to Basel to say, hey, they're allowed to net, so we want to net also. And so they always go to whatever is the easiest on the banks, whatever makes it easier. And so they now allow the European banks to net for the regulation. The accountants do not allow it for the investors, but the regulators can decide whatever they want to do. And so anyway, so there's a tug of war now. Supposedly yesterday, the head of this Basel committee was hinting that maybe, you know, they need more equity or something or other. Anyway, in this country, they are trying to be a little bit tougher than that because Basel is supposed to be a minimum. And then the devil is in many, many details. And you can believe that there are numerous lawyers and numerous lobbyists working on this, where, you know, people like me or people who can understand this and are not working for the banks are way outnumbered in this process.
Sure. I can see that. As far as your suggestions and recommendations and advice on trying to stabilize this financial sector. We have about 8 minutes left, so why don't you tell us something about what's going on in your own mind and part of this book also. What would you recommend at this time to help try to stabilize this financial crisis?
Well, I think that there's a lot to do, but I will focus on the one thing that is kind of a no-brainer, and that it's only confusion in politics that's stopping this from happening.
Okay.
This is about what I was just discussing, which is requirements about how they are allowed to fund and how much debt they can rely on. So banks rely on, for example, deposit funding. This is the most fun for them to rely on because we depositors are not behaving like normal creditors. We forget that the bank owes us the money. So much so that they forget that they owe us the money because it's insured. So they fund with deposits. That's a great start for funding. Anybody would love to fund with deposits because it's the best money around. Very low interest, you know, these creditors don't write many contracts and don't go after you. Then they fund with 1,000 other kinds of debts. and very little money that comes from shareholders. If they were to, when the banks lend to a business, or even to a homeowner, they usually, you know, require, you know, some down payment, or from businesses, they certainly require that there is a lot of owner equity in the business,
yeah,
or
equity,
they wouldn't
yeah.
agree. Sure. 25% is kind of, you know, the banks would insist for a business, certainly
right.
for a corporation if they were to lend. But for themselves, they think they're entitled to live on as little as, you know, 3% as corporations. Now, when you look around, you say, wait a minute, that's not healthy for corporations to live like that, and no corporation lives like that even without regulation. So when you look in my part of the world, Silicon Valley, everybody takes lots of risks. Apple or any of these companies, they don't hardly have any debt at all. Even though we don't force them not to fund with debt, they could borrow. Instead, they fund from retained earnings, from equity, and their stock price goes up, and Warren Buffett never pays dividends and just keeps investing. So if you have something good to do, you can invest your shareholders' money, and you don't have to borrow as much as that. For example, what if banks were forced to have 20 or 30% equity on a regular basis, or so fluctuate within that range instead of between, you know, 2.5 and 7 or 3 and 5 or whatever, the kinds of percentages that they are allowed. That's the way banks used to be funded. And before they had so many safety net, they couldn't, their depositors wouldn't trust them if they didn't have more shareholder money, and even their shareholders didn't have limited liability. They couldn't walk away. If the bank couldn't pay, you could go after their owners. Even in the Depression, you know, the owners of the banks were liable with their own business, like in the partnerships. Right now, there's very little ability to absorb loss within the banks, though some people get the upside and the downside is not theirs. So my first thing to do is to way increase the equity, because very highly leveraged, highly indebted corporations just behave very distorted in their decisions. Everybody who's in distress loves risk, becomes addicted to risk and to borrowing. And the only push against that in functioning market is that the creditors, if it's the banks, won't agree to it. They won't agree to lend to somebody that only has 3% and is opaque and takes all this risk. In other words, if the banks did not have the safety net, they couldn't even borrow as much as they do. We
right.
have to counter that. It's as if we feed their addiction to drive fast. So we have to put speed limits, which is sort of basically force them into the equity market a lot more than they like. But it's really good for the rest of us, because otherwise they just basically extract from the rest of us. And they become healthier corporations, a little more normalized, so that they make better decisions and they make better loans and are not so crazy about the upside and are willing to make that boring business loan that right now they're not necessarily even interested in making. And so that's my first proposal, to kind of get 50 benefits at virtually, you know, free for the economy, just to do better the regulation they were already doing, a whole lot better. It basically was a huge missed opportunity that we didn't do it. And then we should probably do more than that, but the rest is even harder. This one is like the no-brainer of no-brainers, and it's really incredible that they were not even getting that done.
Okay.
So, for example, stop them from paying dividends, because the managers in the end benefit the most from that. Even the shareholders, if we're diversified, it's the shareholders, they're you and me, and we're also depositors, and it's just, you know, it's as if we paid to subsidize, you know, a polluting way to produce something when there is a clean way, equally costly. We just happen to subsidize the debt funding of the banks, even tax subsidies. It's a crazy system. So we encourage them perversely to do this, and then we suffer the consequences. We clean the river. You know, we bury the, you know, the victims of the explosions or whatever.
Right. You know, the banks, you're saying they were highly over-leveraged. Is that right?
High is way, way too high. These are levels you don't ever see anywhere. And the fact that they are, you know, when they tell you banks are special and have to be like that, it's as if they told you, you know, we're a special kind of trucks. Our natural speed is 90 miles an hour in the residential area, you know, that kind of thing. In other words, they're only special in what they get away with, is basically the way I'd say it now. They're not special. They're nobody's so special they should live on 95% debt.
Right. So in that state, I mean, the average corporation, you're comparing them to corporations that normally are less leveraged but in better financial condition because of that less leverage. They're so overly leveraged that any loss that they have is multiplied to their bottom line.
Exactly,
magnified. Severe loss. That's magnified, right?
The upside is magnified. That's why they like the leverage.
Yes,
but the downside wipes them out right away, just like
exactly.
The homeowners felt.
Yeah.
So when the homeowner buys it with little down payment, they go underwater. The banks are underwater, and then, you know, it's somebody else's problem.
Then this, on this financial crisis, they went underwater, then they ran to government to bail them out.
Precisely what happened. So when they became underwater, and so the homeowners, basically everybody who borrowed too much, you know, suffered the consequences except for the banks.
Right.
And the people who allowed it, basically, you know, in other words, the people who allowed the system to become so dangerous, somehow got away with it and now are telling us that, you know, everything is fine now and we are tweaking the regulation, but they're really tweaking very, very little, and far from as much as they really ought to.
Are they going to make it out of the woods on this and this financial crisis or not? What do you think?
Well, who's who? I mean, you know, the economy might, you know, eventually sort of find its way to recovery.
Right.
And, you know, the banks, not that much has changed for the banks. We have a completely unfocused effort to kind of have this reform, but it's really, you know, it's sort of inefficient itself. It's got these monstrous complicated rules. We didn't talk about Volcker rule, all of that. And it's not kind of focusing on the right thing. So in the end, you know, we'll see where we are. I was told 3 years ago, oh, you know, it's kind of too late. We wait to the crisis. You know, people pay attention to these things only in crisis. And, you know, we'll see you after the next crisis. So I'm hoping that's not the case. I'm hoping there's enough. But, you know, the politics of it is such that, you know, in the election, nobody was talking about it because the banks have contributions to every party. And so just like the solution can be bipartisan, and there is a Brown-Vitter law that basically goes a long way towards what I'm saying, which is by senators from two sides of the and there's some kind of proposal about Glass-Steagall that also is bipartisan, but it's even more complicated. But this one is really a good one. You know, if they can get a Brown-Vitter, that would be a start that basically doesn't, it nudges the regulators to do something that they already have authority to do. The regulators, just so you know, have authority to do everything they need to do. But they're pressured by the industry, and sometimes they're pressured by the politicians because the politicians are pressured by the industry. And that's what fails, is the public is losing because there's just too much special interest and there's sort of confusion
politics.
As well.
Yeah, politics.
Politics and confusion together is a real toxic mix, and that's what I've discovered. At first, I didn't understand why there's so much confusion, and then I discovered that it's a sort of blindness. Call it blind spots, but it's really willful blindness to risk and all of that. So I no longer know what people know, what they want to know, but I can tell you it's kind of a toxic mix of politics and confusion and you know, people who benefit from the situation really take advantage of that.
There have been some suicides by bankers just in the last few days. gosh, what's going on out here? Any connection to any of this or not?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's case by case. I mean, you know, there are various things about why, you know, there's sort of high pressure jobs, there is you know, there's pressures to generate returns, there are pressures to take risk, you know. So, you know, I can see that it could cause personal distress enough so that of course if people, you know, become entangled in something or fall out of favor, you know, in whatever they're doing, and you know, there are different kinds. But I, you know, it's a case
It's hard to get to the bottom of some of this, I know. But it's awful suspicious, you know, of this happening like that. Another thing that happened at Davos, I don't know if you were there to see this panel discussion, but Rick Perry, our governor, along with the president of Colombia, Santos, President Santos, both pointed their fingers at money laundering is, by the banks is the primary problem of drug trade.
Yeah. Quite possible. I mean, you know, when you start looking closely at what is done, it's often pretty scary, you know, under the hood kind of thing.
What you can even see.
Then eventually when we find out about some of these things, when we find out about, you know, fraud or about all kinds of breaking the law here and there and everywhere, or just, you know, abusing the regulation or finding loopholes in the regulation so some of it is legal, you know, oftentimes it's too late. You know, we find out that, you know, Lehman was cheating on its financial statement, you know, but it was already in bankruptcy. It was in the bankruptcy report.
Right. We've got about a little over a minute to go. Is there any final concluding comment you'd like to make before we sign off?
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. It's a kind of our book message is that people need to voice their views on that. That, you know, it seems as if it's benign. The risk is very abstract. In other industries, we wouldn't tolerate such an unsafe and inefficient system. But this system can get away with it because people are not involved and because people don't understand the risk that they're put through. And people sometimes are also enticed by, you know, cheap credit. The problem, what people need to understand is, you know, credit should be given appropriately, and the banks sometimes lend too much and sometimes do too little and sometimes at the same time. They get other people to overborrow and live dangerously, and there's a big dark side to that and a bust that follows the boom. So I think we should get a better system, but I'm alarmed unless people get involved, we might not.
Well, Dr. Imani, we certainly appreciate the time you spent with us, and it's very informative. And you described many of these problems in very good, sensible terms that the average listening audience can understand. I certainly appreciate the way you did that.
Yeah, thank you. And that's right. They want you to think it's complicated, and so our book tries to explain it. So I hope people would read it or send it to your senator.
we have the click-offs going in to buy your book already up on the site. But thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
Okay. Good night.